Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Heart disease is by far the leading cause of death for women in the U.S., yet women with heart conditions are less likely than men to get aggressive treatment and more likely to have their symptoms misdiagnosed or even dismissed by doctors. A new book by cancer specialist Elizabeth Komen looks at the way medicine today is disregarding women's health needs and connects it to a long history of gender discrimination that continues to affect diagnosis and treatment. Have you ever felt dismissed or unfairly treated in your doctor's office? Komen's new book is called All in Her Head, and she joins us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Oncologist Elizabeth Komen remembers it vividly, leaning in to say a final goodbye to a patient near death, and the patient apologizing for sweating on her. It wasn't the first time a female patient had apologized for sweating or asking too many questions or just taking up space. And Komen sees this as part of a legacy in medicine that has brushed aside women's complaints, dismissed symptoms, or misunderstood the distinct ways disease can affect their bodies. Komen, who's a breast cancer specialist at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, has a new book called All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Welcome to Forum, Dr. Komen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you. You have treated thousands of patients in your two decades as a physician. Can you say a little more about how often women patients apologize to you and the range of things they are sorry for?
Oh, on any given clinic day, I would say the majority of patients apologize to me for everything from not shaving to sweating to being anxious to asking questions to feeling flustered for being in pain. You name it, and I've heard apologies.
And what is the legacy that you connect this to, the medical legacy that you say that women who apologize are part of?
I think it's a very complex, sordid history where women's medical complaints have been dismissed, at times invalidated. Of course, this is not true of, you know, it's not a blanket statement of all of our medical ills, but in far too many ways, our medical care mirrored the treatment of women in society. And I think there's been, at best, an insidious incuriosity about women's health, and at worst, real dismissal that continues to play out even in the best of intentioned ways today.
Insidious incuriosity. What do you mean by that?
I mean that, you know, that the medical system has at times been incurious about what has been going on with women in a way that is latent and subtle, but significantly impactful. So, for example, one thing that we often see in postmenopausal women is a condition called frozen shoulder, where there's pain and difficulty in moving the shoulder. This is a condition that predominantly affects women, although it can affect men. And historically, the treatment of that was benign neglect. It was literally called benign neglect in the literature. And it could take years if it ever got better for some women. And the medical community largely said, well, this is something that male orthopedic doctors are seeing in women. And, you know, they're there. It'll get better. And, of course, we know that that's not an appropriate way to treat someone who can't move a limb and is in significant pain. But when you have a setup where it was predominantly male physicians taking care of women, diseases that acutely or predominantly affected them were often not addressed as carefully and as thoughtfully as I believe they can and are in hopefully more instances today.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join the conversation. Have you ever had a medical condition that you felt was ignored or undiagnosed by your doctor? Do you suspect that this was on account of your gender? You can email forum at kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum, and you can call us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. I'm wondering if you could talk about the concept of hysteria, which pervaded the practice of medicine for hundreds of years, what it means, its origins as a diagnosis.
Sure. Well, the word hysteria derives from the Greek word for womb. And going back to ancient, really remarkable physicians who, let's give them the best benefit of the doubt, were doing their best, but really laid out a lot of treatises that suggested that women's behavior, women's medical ills were secondary to this wandering womb. And it was that which has made women hysterical and challenging to understand from a medical perspective, from a psychological perspective. And through the years, the vision, the ghost of this hysterical woman continued to infiltrate our medical system. Whether even once we knew that the womb did not wander and you didn't need to kind of reposition it by putting a woman in bizarre positions or using smelling salts into your parts of her body, then it became, well, maybe it's the ovaries that are making her crazy. Maybe it's the estrogen that's all throughout her body that's making her crazy. And at various points in medical history, you can see this play out, whether it's the anxious housewife that you just need to get to calm down with anxiety medications, whether it is the woman with irritable bowel syndrome who's difficult and emotional. Maybe they're called hysterical as well. And we know that the hysterical as a diagnosis was not even removed from medical lexicon until the 1980s. And I think we see this today where far too many women feel that they are told that they're anxious or they need to calm down, or as the title of my book suggests, it's all in your head.
Yeah, well, Helen on Instagram writes, "My doctor was Harvard trained. When I went in with pins and needles all over my body, she blamed it on stress and anxiety. They didn't run any tests, so I paid for it out of pocket and found I was deficient in vitamin D and B12. You have talked about how when you say the title of your book, All in Her Head, that people immediately relate with a story to tell about a similar experience they've had in a doctor's office. Do you want to say a little bit more about the nerve you think you're touching, what you're tapping into with this All in Her Head?
Yeah. You know, coming up with the title of a book is hard. And we didn't originally have a title that I loved, that I really spoke to the kernel of the book. And when we went through iterations and finally came to All in Her Head, it was almost an immediate reaction from the people I was working with and my literary agent and the publisher. My gosh, this is the title. This is the title because it resonates with each of us. And I wish it didn't strike such a chord, but in my speaking engagements and in talking with women in public and private settings, almost every woman has some sort of story where they feel that they were told that something was all in their head. And of course, sometimes we are anxious and sometimes we are stressed, but that shouldn't be a default answer to biological medical problems.
Yeah. And do you feel like, you mentioned that hysteria is sort of out of the medical literature, but do you feel like anxiety can be used as a modern equivalent?
I do. I think that, you know, I'm guilty of this as well. As doctors, we are trained in math and science, and we all want language that helps us control and understand the universe, much of which we can't control and understand. And by nature, and sometimes the best of intentioned ways, we want to be able to label things, because when we label things and when we name them, we can try to fix them. And a lot of the body we don't understand. And when it comes to women's health, there is a discrepancy in how much we've been researched, understood, included in clinical trials, how much our care has been tended to in an objective lens. And because of that, I think that there is this notion that when we can't figure out what's going on with women, and of course, someone would be anxious if you don't know what's wrong with them, it's an easy default to say, oh, she's just anxious. She's just anxious, when perhaps there's more to the story that we can understand.
And this even happens with heart disease, something we seem to know and understand relatively well.
Relatively well, but not well enough, because heart disease is the number one killer of women in this country. And we know that women are more likely to call an ambulance on their husband having heart attack symptoms than themselves. And across the board, women's heart disease symptoms, heart attack symptoms, are often presenting in different ways than men. And because of that, even during my medical training, the presentation of a heart attack in a woman was considered atypical relative to a man. And so when you already use language that we are atypical, that our presentation is different, then it's not surprising that when women present in emergency rooms, we are more likely to be dismissed for having anxiety or in other settings than actually have our potentially heart attack symptoms appropriately addressed.
Yeah, so atypical things like jaw and back pain may be more common in women, for example. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the very famous and celebrated doctor that may be the root of women's heart failure or women's heart disease symptoms being declared all in their heads?
Yeah. So I've got a lot of mixed feelings about this man because he did so many good things. And I'm not about taking down statues and paintings, but rather contextualizing them so that we can constructively move forward. So Sir William Osler was a famous physician who really advanced the field of medical science and medicine in the United States. He also founded the residency system at Johns Hopkins, which Wow. was the model for our medical system and our training and rigorous medical training that really advanced the field. And when I wanted to go back and understand some of the roots of this idea that the typical person to have a heart attack was that overworked, white-haired, middle-aged man, I went back to a lot of his treatises on heart disease, and I was really shocked and disappointed. So he describes the classic woman having chest pain as having what he called neurotic angina meaning chest pain. And he goes on to list many, many different scenarios, each starting with Miss C or Miss B, the first letter of their last name, describing their life, their symptoms, and ultimately that what they had was not true chest pain secondary to structural or biological disease, but that they were in fact neurotic and they did not die. Well, of course that's not true. Women with heart disease do die. And then when he goes on to describe men, it's these classic symptoms of, you know, the elephant on the chest, the clutching chest pain. This would be found in an overworked man. And when I read a little bit more about Sir William Osler, there was an interesting article in the Washington Post from quoting one of the first female graduates of Johns Hopkins. As a medical student, she crossed paths with Sir William Osler, and he looked at her and said, "Are you here for medical school?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Don't come, go home." Mm. And so, you know, you see how these complex personalities did a lot of good, but also laid the groundwork for, as I said, a lot of the legacy of inequality in our healthcare system that presents day in and day out. And so I use history to help frame where we've come from, but hopefully constructively to figure out how we can close those gaps moving forward.
Yeah, and we're coming up on a break, but you use history to also connect it to, say, less aggressive treatment that women receive for heart disease than a man, for example. If you just want to say a quick word about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just less aggressive treatment, but how we visualize heart disease. The vessels may look different. Mm. It's a wonderful woman that I interviewed, Dr. Nanette Wegner, one of the oldest practicing cardiologists. She went to Harvard Medical School, and she's really done extraordinary work to show that women's heart disease is different. We may need different medications. We may need different recovery, and we may need our disease visualized differently.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Coleman. Her new book is All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. And we're hearing from you, our listeners, about experiences that you've had, either having things treated as if they're all in your head or conditions going undiagnosed or ignored. We'll have more after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Medicine has made significant shifts and advancements over centuries, but the way women's bodies are regarded or treated has not kept pace, leading to harmful effects like doctors brushing off symptoms or misdiagnosing patients, or women struggling to advocate for themselves in medical settings, according to Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, an oncologist specializing in breast cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Her new book is All in Her Head. Have you had a medical condition, listeners, that went undiagnosed or ignored by your doctor? Do you think this was because of your gender? Have you ever been told that a medical issue you're experiencing is all in your head? Maybe you feel that these dismissals have been on account of something else or something intersecting with gender. Are you a medical professional? Have you noticed gender bias in your field or made efforts to root it out? You can email forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels. Our digital community is Discord. We're on Instagram, on X. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. This listener writes, a couple years ago, I went to the ER with extreme lower abdominal cramps. As soon as I mentioned that I had a partner with whom I was sexually active, the male doctor diagnosed me with STDs. I insisted that he first rule out a ruptured ovarian cyst, since the female nurse said she assumed that's what I had. He grudgingly ordered x-rays for me. After getting the results back, he said, there's no sign of a ruptured ovarian cyst, so we're going to start treating you for STDs. I had a bad feeling about it, so I left without treatment. The next morning, I went to my OBGYN, showed her all the test results, and she said, oh, you had a ruptured ovarian cyst. It says here in your x-ray results. Let me go to caller Anne in Oakland. Anne, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for this. I've related to so much to what you were saying in the beginning about apologizing for things when you're at the doctor's office. But I called because I wanted to talk about like the shame that's still attached to women's bodies. And when we go to the doctor, you know, sometimes we're feeling decades of this shame and lack of information that we received when growing up about what is supposed to be happening with our bodies. And I think I've had a lot of that. You know, I'm 50 years old, I'm approaching menopause, and I don't really know what's supposed to be happening with me. And I have had some negative experiences with doctors just kind of brushing me off and not wanting to give me more information. And so thank you.
Well, thank you, Anne, for sharing that. And I really appreciate you bringing shame into this because, Dr. Komen, that is one of the things that you specifically point out.
I'm so sorry. I can hear the pain and the experiences that you've had. And I think so many of us can relate. I often am asked, why did I write the book the way that I did? And it's with a lot of stories from the past and the present, as opposed to kind of like a 10-step wellness guide. And in part of telling these stories is because I think we can recognize a lot of these threads of shame and blame and validation being made to feel small in whether it's a woman in the 17th century or a patient who may come to me in my practice. And the idea of telling these stories is to really understand this legacy of shame and figure out how we move forward from it. I do believe that we are taught this societally, culturally, many in terms of religion. And in order to move forward from that, we need to have conversations like these where we normalize talking about women's bodies, where we start at a young age to validate and name the parts of women's bodies and say they are not vulgar, they are not dirty. If you look at a man, you know, they can mansplain and sit on the subway with their legs wide open. And women are not allowed to do that. So I think it starts on so many different levels. And the more we can talk openly, authentically, and there are many men who support this mission as well, I think together we can kind of work to eradicate this legacy of shame.
Yeah, you talk about how, you know, issues related to the female reproductive system seem to bring out a particularly odd response. Odd is the best word I guess I can think of at the moment. But you've cited things like misdiagnosis for ovarian cancer. I don't know if you want to say just a little bit more about that as just one example of when the female reproductive system is involved, misdiagnosis feels rampant.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating looking through history how much we are focused on as vessels and how much we learn about puberty and hormones, but we don't learn very much in medical school about menopause. And the aging woman is often not focused on, even though, again, we're greater than 50% of the population and spend potentially decades postmenopausal. Ovarian cancer is a particularly sad example because it's often called the silent killer, because the symptoms that women may be presenting with, maybe years of bloating, abdominal discomfort, change in bowel habits, are often considered silent symptoms. And I think it really speaks to what we're missing in medicine, which is listening to women first, creating a system that allows for, in a perfect world, and I know it's not, more than 15-minute crunched appointments where we can listen and distill from women what are their symptoms so that we can better catch things like ovarian cancer and other significant illnesses earlier and without less and with less suffering.
What's your reaction to the listener who wrote in who had a ruptured ovarian cyst and the doctor insisted she had an STD?
Well, I definitely would want more details on that because STDs are, you have to biologically diagnose them. I mean, those are with swabs and laboratory analysis. So I'm not really sure how that happened, but the idea that a woman is dismissed or that we are assumed to be carriers as opposed to recipients of STDs and the shame in that. One of the shocking things in my research was looking at the history of STDs and just how often women are blamed as being dirty and carriers, you know, the equivalent of typhoid Mary, but for sexually transmitted diseases, as the men, on the contrast, particularly soldiers, are at risk from that, you know, clean woman that looks so beautiful and so healthy, but lurking below is this horrible, horrific STD that you could get from her, let alone forget the fact that you might be spreading it to another woman.
Well, Pam writes, now think about being a female and being African-American, given the unconscious bias that has been shown to exist in even the best of doctors. I've been outwardly shamed by both male and female doctors. I even had a hot and itchy bug bite that a male doctor made a lewd comment about. Do you want to just talk a little bit about just the outcomes and experiences of women of color? Because you have described just how, yes, these are the types of things that have happened historically frequently to white women of means, and that women of color, you know, are viewed by medical, you know, the medical establishment as being even less of someone who understands and knows their bodies and worthy of compassion.
Sure. Well, of course, we're all worthy of compassion. And one of the messages of my book is that I think that men and women as caregivers are equally capable of that feminine nurturing spirit, regardless of the sex that they are born. And it's not about a war of the sexes at all. And also, when thinking about racism and the history of Black women in this country, one of the really horrific things in researching this book was just realizing just how much racism and misogyny went hand in hand, just how much the type of stories that I'm talking about in women who do have resources, who do have access, is compounded for women of color, women of minority status, and really if they also have compromised socioeconomic factors as well. It is just so hard to get care in this country. We talk about worse Black maternal health, infant health. It's not just in those areas. It is head to toe. In my practice of oncology and breast cancer, we know that Black women are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer than other ethnicities and race. We also know that, yes, Black women can have a slightly higher incidence of something called triple negative breast cancer, which can have worse outcomes because of the nature of the aggressiveness of the disease. But in large part, this increased mortality is not secondary to the biology of the disease, but access to quality care, issues with the type of screening that they can get, access, and being able to go to an academic center for the best quality care, as well as inclusion in clinical trials.
Let me go to caller Gia at Travis Air Force Base. Hi, Gia. Gia, you're on.
Yes, thank you so very much for having this topic. This took place in a military setting over a period of years where I completely had excruciating pain, would go into the doctor and complain about the same thing, not anything different, each time, and not only excruciating pain, but dark, starry, bloody stool, and then finally, at one point, going into the emergency room where I could not even walk, I had to be carried in, and was told by the emergency room doc that maybe I should seek some counseling, some psychiatric counseling. And I'm a mental health professional. And so I was afraid because they're in a military setting. I also worked, and I was afraid. And then finally, after a period of time, was diagnosed with a stage 3 colon cancer, which had gotten so large by the time it was diagnosed, and of course it took place over a period of years, that it was almost it was touching the wall but not penetrating. Ended up having to go through chemo as well as some other issues that happened as a result of that. But I really thank you so very, very much for having this happening. But I also feel extremely strongly about the fact that I was not only a female in a military setting, but a woman of color in a military setting, where one is supposed to suck it up. And then also, if you are working in that military setting, you know, you're afraid for your career, as well as other repercussions that may occur. So thank you so very much.
Well, Gia, thank you. Dr. Komen, Gia is touching on so many different elements of things you touch on in your book as well, if you have a comment.
Yeah, I'm just so heartbroken for your experience. And also, it's not included in the book, but after I wrote the book, I spoke to a lot of female veterans, and many of these women in the military are rising quickly, and the number of women in the military is increasing. And yet, I don't think we've necessarily kept pace with how we care for women in the military, particularly some of the exposures that they have, the fire pits they're exposed to abroad, and how this may increase their cancer risk, how we're appropriately increasing screening for these women that have had maybe significant toxic exposures. And the idea that, you know, you had these symptoms that were so long dismissed, I'm just so sorry, and I'm glad that you're well today.
Well, Dina writes, I'm an ovarian cancer survivor who underwent a full hysterectomy. Years later, when I asked a doctor about a medical symptom, she dismissed me with, "You are probably on your period." When a friend of mine who died very young of late diagnosed cancer noticed unusual abdominal swelling, the doctor dismissed her, saying, "You are post-menopause and you have to get used to not being skinny." My question is, what are we going to do about this? Are there any feasible efforts to retrain doctors during medical school and residency? Is there any way to change the incentives to force doctors to care about women's symptoms?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot that's going to happen in medical education. You know, President Biden just signed today an executive order to expand and improve research on women's health. This is a dramatic initiative by Dr. Jill Biden as well, the White House Women's Research Initiative, along with Maria Shriver. They're doing extraordinary work to show that investing in women's health is not just the right and ethical thing to do, but redounds to a healthier society and a more productive workforce, to say the least. But there are so many areas that are underfunded, underserved, that go beyond this idea of bikini medicine, of just breasts and ovarian and uterine reproductive function, but things like autoimmune diseases, which are 80% more likely in women, heart disease we talked about, the fact that lung cancer among non-smokers is on the rise in women, rheumatologic conditions. There are so many areas of research that we know we need to do. And I think from all the way from the clinical experience and how we train doctors to the lab and the types of animal models that we use and cells that we use, there's a lot of movement to recognize that we need to be inclusive of women.
Yes. And you make a strong point that sexism, gender discrimination in medicine can be perpetuated by both men and women. And I don't know if you want to just say a quick word about that.
Yeah, I again, you know, it's too reductionist to just say, oh, we're going to do better because we're going to include more women in medicine, and it's men that have contributed to this. And okay, yes, we could be that simplistic, but it would really do a disservice to the whole medical system. In reality, much of our medical system today was not built by women, but was built by men, and women and a lot of their strengths were sidelined along the way. That does not have to be the case now. I think the more that we can have women in positions of power, women in positions of leadership that are fair and equitable. Additionally, there are incredible male healers out there who are compassionate, who listen. And this is more about how we cultivate those talents in all sexes and genders, as opposed to assume that women necessarily have to do it better.
What do you actively try to do? Your awareness of it means that you're also aware that you are in danger of persisting or perpetuating certain ideas about women or treating women differently in the medical setting. What do you do to guard against this legacy that can pervade anyone of any gender and take women patients' complaints more seriously?
I think really taking a deeper dive into individually, what as women, what are the stories we've been told ourselves? I think that impacts how we, even for female physicians, who and how we practice. I think for physicians and nurses and nurse practitioners and healthcare providers, it is about having an education in this legacy that we've inherited. And it also redounds to patients as well to say, I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to trust my gut. I'm going to advocate for myself. And if I feel like I can, I'm going to bring somebody with me to help me along the way so that I come prepared with questions. And if I am not comfortable, then I find another doctor who I feel is really going to listen to me and partner with me.
And just in terms of practice, do you do things like, you know, additional testing? I'm just curious.
I don't think additional testing is necessarily the way to go. I think a really good doctor has the time, hopefully in an institutional practice or private practice, to listen to patients. One of the things we know is the less you listen, the more tests you order. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, you can discern what's going on with a patient by listening to them, listening really well. Less about lab tests, less about whole body scans, but listening really well, and from there, refining what sorts of medical interventions are necessary, whether they be medications or imaging and diagnostic tools to better understand a condition that someone may be presenting with.
Let me go to caller Amy in San Francisco. Amy, you're on.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I think this has been such a very useful conversation as someone who was told for well over 10 years that I had anxiety. My tests were normal. It was just me being anxious when it turns out I had Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. I think something that would be interesting to talk about is just the power dynamics that are in the room, particularly between medical providers and patients, and how that plays a significant role in making it hard for a patient to advocate themselves and putting the burden on the patient all the time for trying and trying to advocate for themselves. And after they've been told they have anxiety multiple times, it's very hard to step back up again. I was wondering if there's any thoughts about teaching in the future for that.
Yeah, well, white coat syndrome is real, right? The idea that people's blood pressure can be elevated just by seeing a white coat. And there is this sense of authority and power dynamic that exists when you show up at a doctor's office. Plus, you may be exposing parts of your body, sharing intimate parts of your life, feeling extremely vulnerable, whether physically and emotionally, in what you want to share. And sometimes that's with someone that you barely know, especially if it's an emergency room. So inherently, there is that awkwardness, that power dynamic. And also, I think it's compounded for women because we are taught to, you know, not make people uncomfortable and behave as much as possible. So I think that's really where having somebody with you helps advocate for what you need to address in a variety of medical settings.
Amy, thanks so much for bringing up that point. And we'll have more about gender discrimination in medicine, power differentials between doctors and patients, as Amy just raised, how legitimate medical complaints can be dismissed and diagnosed, especially for women. More with Dr. Komen after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the profound health impacts that persistent gender bias in medicine can have, can lead to things like women being misdiagnosed or more likely to have legitimate medical complaints dismissed. We're talking about it with Dr. Elizabeth Coman, an oncologist specializing in breast cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and author of the new book, All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. And we're hearing about those experiences from you, our listeners, as well. Dr. Coman, you mentioned lung disease as something that's not being diagnosed or getting misdiagnosed. What's going on with that? I'm curious.
Well, it's interesting. You know, this is among non-smokers, actually. But side note, that there was in the history of medicine a real push to get women to smoke cigarettes because the tobacco companies knew that this was an untapped market. And there was a psychiatrist that was actually hired by PR teams in the tobacco world to harp on this idea or capitalize on the idea that when women smoked, they were smoking torches of freedom. And this was their way of showing that they too were liberated. If you look at a lot of the ads for cigarettes and women, it was you know, these Virginia Slims, and they were the ideal way to demonstrate your sense of feminism and freedom. When it comes to smoking now, or not smoking now, lung cancer rates now, they are significantly on the rise in non-smoking women, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that area, particularly because their symptoms may be missed along the way. We typically think of the classic lung cancer patient as a older age smoker, and that's not the case for many of the women that are presenting.
Yeah, and that a lot of times when people are presenting with symptoms related to lung disease, that they have been dismissed as having a panic disorder of some kind, like acute respiratory failure often being...
Yeah. So, you know, anxiety obviously can present with shortness of breath, but in the hospital, there are far too many examples when I spoke with pulmonologists of women having significant respiratory distress that was unfortunately perceived in the acute setting as anxiety before it was really tackled. Another area of interest with respect to respiratory disease is that when a woman is pregnant and her, obviously her uterus is bigger and it can press up upon the diaphragm, some women can have some element of shortness of breath and decreased exercise tolerance during pregnancy. But in many instances, as I spoke to different pulmonologists, sometimes things as simple as asthma may be dismissed in pregnancy as just a function of their being pregnant when in fact they had other pulmonary disorders.
Well, Rebecca writes, misdiagnosis has been the story of my life. Things as simple as a rash and a UTI have been misdiagnosed, but the worst case was my quest to get to the bottom of a handful of very concerning symptoms that were ultimately correctly diagnosed as multiple sclerosis in 2012. Before my diagnosis, I was told many times that it was psychosomatic or stress-related. Another listener writes, having suffered many of the health challenges women are dismissed for, with profound losses touching every aspect of my life, I feel I need to point out that the problems aren't just when diseases are misdiagnosed, or when doctors or when women don't look sick, or because of bad or arrogant doctors. The problem is the paradigm of medicine itself, and I'm sorry to say, it's little better today than 30 years or 130 years ago. I'm wondering, when you experience women apologizing to you and so on, is this women of all ages? Does it tend to be older women maybe who had been subject to, you know, certain levels of gender discrimination that we've maybe made some progress from since? Or do you see it also in young women too?
I think I definitely see it in older women. But I see it in young women as well. You know, we're trying to have this new generation of empowered women.
Yeah.
But I do see a lot of young women with breast cancer in my practice similarly apologizing for sweating, for not having a pedicure, for asking questions. And I think we just need to continue to encourage that bond that we don't need to be apologizing for everything all the time.
Yeah. Can you talk about your own doubt of a self-diagnosis that you made?
Oh, yeah. So when I wrote my book, I had finished writing the whole thing other than the conclusion. And then I'd had a small back surgery and 6 weeks later had a complication from it where I developed horrible, horrible, horrible pain, headaches when I raised my head. But when I put my head back down, the pain subsided, at least initially. And I very quickly said to my friend, you know, I think I'm leaking cerebral spinal fluid. So from my internally where I had this small back surgery, because your brain is also bathed in the same fluid that's connected to your spine. And if you lose it distally, you know, towards the lower part of your spine, it still means that what's around your brain, there's less fluid. So the brain can feel almost sucked downward into the spinal canal and can cause really bad headaches. Some women can have that after an epidural during childbirth. But long story short, I was in the setting of speaking to other doctors at a social gathering, mentioned this, and they said to me, oh, you know, you're crazy for thinking that. How could that possibly happen? And they gave me a couple ideas of other diagnoses, and then I carried forward what they told me I had, as opposed to telling my doctor, who I did communicate with via email instead of calling because I didn't want to bother him, about what these other doctors thought I had. And it really led to a delay in diagnosis. I ultimately made it to the emergency room but had some swelling in my brain. And at the end of the day, with all of my resources, I had just written a book about advocating for your healthcare. I'm definitely tapped into the medical community and have access to quality doctors. I did not listen to my gut. And once I got to the emergency room, I apologized for not wearing deodorant. So there you go. If it's hard for me, I can't imagine how hard it must be for other women.
Yes. What actions, you've sort of alluded to them throughout this conversation, but I don't know if you want to just put a finer point on actions that the medical establishment most urgently needs to take to try to address something that even you, writing a book, your resources, your knowledge, can be affected by.
I think first and foremost, we have to pause when we immediately label someone as anxious or tell them to calm down or call them hysterical. I think that's a first step because it happens too easily where we just dismiss somebody as difficult when really they may be suffering. I think we have to catch ourselves in that language because language does reveal character and it impacts behavior. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. And then, of course, without putting too much of a burden on the patient, I really do encourage patients to have an advocate with them, come up with questions ahead of time, particularly if they feel like they've been running around the medical system inappropriately.
Yes, an advocate, because it is really hard if you are concerned about your doctor maybe not providing you with the care that you need to change doctors these days with regard to just shortages in certain fields or insurance requirements and so on. So having somebody with you, I guess, as an extra set of eyes and ears can be really important.
Yeah. And mentorship as well. So for some of these fields like urology, orthopedic surgery, electrophysiology, which studies electrical conductivity of the heart, and we know that women can present with different types of heart arrhythmias, it's important that we continue to encourage women to go into these fields, make it feasible for them to, and encourage, because there are lots of women with a lot of different interests that could add tremendous value to these other fields.
This listener writes, I feel like focusing on the medical community misses the other side of the equation, and that is how the patient communicates. I really hope this conversation highlights that all patients don't have to be passive in their communication and care. Is there some kind of an exercise you can do or just something to help you as you go into that environment in a medical setting to be able to truly communicate what you want answers for?
Yeah, one of the things I really encourage patients is to think about, what is that one question or one concern that you've just kind of always wanted to ask your doctor, but you're just really worried about what they're going to think of you? Chances are your doctor really entered medicine with a desire to care for you. They're there because they do care. And yes, it's an imperfect system and maybe they're tired and hungry, but we are there because we care. And the more our patients trust us, the more we can better access your care. I think the other thing is to maybe even have a mantra, like whatever I've been told about my body, I deserve good care today. I deserve to feel better today. I may not be able to fix everything that's wrong with me or what I'm feeling, but I deserve to have more knowledge and I deserve to be cared for.
Let me go to caller Lily in San Francisco. Lily, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, thank you so much for having this conversation. So I really wanted to kind of talk about the connection between the mental and physical. And I think one of the things that I've experienced my entire life, from chronic pain, chronic bladder kidney issues, chronic fatigue, IBS, all of those things. I have gone in for years. I mean, I'm in my late 30s now, and this has been an issue since I was in my teens. And going in to see different doctors with something that I always assumed was an individual issue that I was having, like chronic pain or my stomach issues. And I was always dismissed and told, oh, it's fine. You're probably okay. X, Y, and Z. And so I kind of just learned to deal with all of these really debilitating issues on my own. And then it wasn't until about 5 years ago when I was speaking to my male therapist, actually, who I had been working with for years, and I casually mentioned something about my IBS, and he said to me, well, how come this is the first time you're bringing this up? And I said, well, because we're in therapy. This isn't the physical doctor's office. And he said, well, you know that a lot of these issues are tied together with a lot of the mental health issues that you've been dealing with. And then I started really looking into it, and there is this incredible link between like the physical and mental that I think, you know, your guest touched on earlier in terms of that, like doctors are trained in science and data. And if they can't get their hands on something tangible, then it's sort of dismissed. But, you know, I was eventually diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And it's a very real thing. I suffer every day from a lot of physical ailments that seem to have kind of no known causes. And so it's so easy for doctors to just dismiss. But I think the reality is that there needs to be a lot more study and education on how the mental and physical are tied together.
Lily, thank you for that. And actually, I do wonder about how to manage the interplay of illnesses that can be like physical manifestations of illnesses that can be caused by stress or anxiety, while also taking care to not dismiss them as, you know, anxious when that's not it at all.
Yeah. Well, the mind-body connection is real, and there's still so much that we're uncovering about that. But certainly when you're in pain, that can make you anxious, that can make you depressed, it can be a vicious cycle. We know that you can have, you know, the gut itself has a brain of its own too that's connected. So there's a lot that we have not understood about how the body works. We know that our modern medical system is broken into these siloed subspecialties of, you know, immunology, neurology, orthopedics. But in reality, we are whole people, and that is a complex interweb that we are still unfolding, and that includes the mind-body connection in many different ways.
Yeah, and just keeping those things in mind. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Coleman. The book is All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Going to more calls, Mark in Berkeley. Thanks so much for joining us. You're on, Mark.
Thank you. Not to take away from this very valid issue. I wanted to say to the extent gender expression or sexual orientation are at play here. This whole story in this segment has brought me back to when I was in college. I went to the student health service with some burning in my eyes and other places, and the doctor said I had an STD, and I said, well, I've only had sex with one person in my life. It's been more than a year. This, no way I have an STD. She insisted I did, of course, tested me, didn't even look in my files and listen to me. I'd started this new medication, a sulfa drug for my rheumatoid arthritis, ended up getting incredibly ill with something called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, almost dying in the hospital for 5 weeks because she, I guess, just assumed because I was a gay man, I must have an STD, and it couldn't possibly be anything else.
Oh, Mark.
I am so sorry that happened to you. And I'm familiar with Stevens-Johnson syndrome. My God, that is horrific. And, you know, we talked about compounded experiences in medicine, whether it's misogyny and racism, and equally homophobia and the treatment of our gay population in the United States is horrific as well. And I said to a lot of my friends, I don't know that I'm the right person to write that book, but the history of what you're describing also needs to be written. There is very clear historical and present data to say that our medical system was not built with a diversity of spirit or patients in mind, and that has had grave consequences for far too many people.
Thank you, Mark, for sharing that. Well, Alicia writes, I was in a car accident hit by an oncoming driver. I felt minor aches as a result of the collision, but I went to the doctor the next day just to be sure there was nothing more serious. The doctor checked my range of motion in my neck and back and sent me home. Over the course of the following week, I started experiencing headaches and nausea and was concerned I had a concussion. I contacted the same doctor and expressed this concern, but he said the headaches and nausea were probably just muscle tension and that I should take painkillers and use a heating pad. I found his nonchalant attitude surprising and disturbing given the circumstance. Let me go to Nancy in Berkeley. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. yes, over my many years of experience with doctors, I've got lots of stories, but I'll tell you one. I was 35. I had just had my second child, and I had what the gynecologist said was fibroid tumors, but I never knew. I mean, they didn't bother me whatsoever. And I went to see this older male gynecologist, and he said, well, he said, you've got fibroid tumors. He said, we'll just do a hysterectomy. He said, you're not going to have any more children, are you? And I said, no. And he said, I said, but they don't bother me. He said, but they will. He said, we'll just get rid of the whole thing. And I just looked at him, and I said, are you going to have any more children? And he said, no. I said, well, maybe we should get rid of your balls.
Whoa.
Well, that was ballsy.
Well, Marilyn writes, I came in to see a new OBGYN because I had bad vulvar pain, and the doctor dismissed it and recommended I have a drink before having sex. People are very interesting when it comes to our reproductive system. Dr. Komen, we just have about a minute left, and I just want to ask you about, you know, there are a lot of things happening in medicine technologically. I think you've raised some concerns about the digitization of medical records and whether or not that will compound some of the issues that you've talked about. Or is there anything that you just want to highlight about where medicine is going, where you either see, you know, greater vigilance needed or hope?
You know, there's lots of reason to have hope. You're talking about the electronic medical record. There's billing codes. We know that so many issues that women face, we can't even bill for it because no one's labeled it. I think in this increasing age of technology and artificial intelligence, of course, we could all be reduced to numbers and letters, but none of us are that. We are whole people with mind, body, and spirits, and the more we can remember that in our healthcare system and remember that we are the ones that are shaping this technology. It is not some runaway train or robot, that we have the power to control how we imbue our medical system with the spirit of nurturing and caring that all of us deserve.
Well, Dr. Komen, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Elizabeth Komen, the book is All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Thank you, Susie Britton, for producing today's segment. Thank you, listeners, for sharing your stories and examples that you've been through, painful, hopeful, funny. We appreciate it so much. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.